Okay, we're going to continue this this speaking series here, and we're talking again about the first three steps, and you've heard Mia talk about step one, and Heather talk about step two, and now Miriam is going to share her experience on step three.
Hi, I'm Miriam, and I'm a compulsive eater in recovery.
Hi, Miriam.
Hi. Thanks. Great to be here today. So step three, I'm really grateful that the steps are in an order, you know, come in an order. And so if I look on page 60, I'm actually going to read through this with you because it's not all that long. And it was actually suggested to me at one point just to read step three over and over again for a few weeks, you know, and I ended up doing it for a year or something like that, which is good because it's one way to memorize the step three prayer, you know, if you just read it over and over again. But in the middle of step of page 60, it sets up our readiness for step three. So it says in A, in the middle, well, right before it, our description of the alcoholic or compulsive overeater, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after makes clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives at step one. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive overeating, that's step two. C, that God could and would if God were sought, that's step two also. So then, being convinced of steps one and two, we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will, which is our thinking and our lives, our actions, over to the care of God as we understood God. Just what do we mean by this, and just what do we do? And it was pointed out to me that that step three says made a decision. It doesn't say we turned our will and our lives over to the care of God. It says we made a decision to do it. And so, see if I can remember the story. I'm sure I'm going to do it wrong. There are, I always mess up. Forgive me, but anyway, I'm going to try it. So there are three frogs on lily pads, and one of them makes a decision to jump off the lily pads. How many are left on the lily pads? Three, because he just made a decision. He didn't actually jump off, you know, and so that's what step three is about. It's making the decision, but then the rest is to do, it's a decision, really, to follow through with the rest of the steps. That's what step three is about. So the first requirement. And so they say that there are no, that everything is suggestion in this program. I don't agree. The first requirement, it's a suggestion if you don't want to recover. But if you want to recover, it's a requirement. The first requirement is that we can be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. It was suggested to me that I change this language to put my own name in there. So I'm going to read it the way I do. So Miriam is like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in her own way. If her arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as she wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including Miriam, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, Miriam may sometimes be quite virtuous. She may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, she may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, she is more likely to have varied traits. So I love what somebody had pointed out to me in the beginning of this paragraph, where it says, everybody, including Miriam, would be pleased. You know, that would be true if I could be God, you know, then everybody would be pleased. But in fact, I'm not God, which is part of the recognition of step two and then step three. The point here is that my motives are always selfish. Even if I think that I'm being kind, it's really all about getting what I want in one way or another. So what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. She begins to think life doesn't treat her right. She decides to exert herself more. She becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit her. Admitting she may be somewhat at fault, she is sure that other people are more to blame. She becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is her basic trouble? Is she not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is she not the victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction or take away by force satisfaction and happiness out of this world if she only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things she wants? And do not her actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is she not even in her best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? You know, I mean, this really describes what my whole life strategy was before I came into the rooms. It was really about doing everything I possibly could to get what I wanted, even if I thought what I wanted was a good thing. But it was all about, I thought if I just worked really hard and did the right thing, you know, I could get what I wanted. And I met someone who was in a 12-step program who talked about surrendering to God. And I thought, you're crazy. You know, what are you talking about? You'll work really hard and then you get what you want. And when I came in here, all of my thinking really was turned on its head. But I'll talk about that in a little later. So Miriam is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. She's like the retired business person who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged her and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And selfishness, it was described to me, the difference between selfishness and self-centeredness. Selfishness is, give it to me, it's mine, I want it. And self-centeredness is, I can't think of anything but myself. And of course, I was focused on both of those things. That we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So, you know, when I first came into this program, I thought that, I was a victim. And, I ate because I came from a horrible family and all the things they did to me and, you know, I had a really bad childhood and all this stuff, you know, and there is some truth to some of the stuff that happened to me as a kid, you know, I had absolutely no control over. But a lot of my problems in life were really based on things that I set in motion, if nothing else by my expectations and the way that I operated in the world. And that's a really wonderful thing, because if all of my problems are really because of something that happened, something outside of myself, I can't do anything about it. But if in fact I'm at the core of all my problems, then I have a chance. And thankfully, there's a whole set of steps here that enable me to look at my part, which, you know, we'll talk about, I guess, next week with the fourth step, but so that I really can do whatever is in my control with, of course, the help of God. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic or compulsive overeater is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though she usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we compulsive overeaters must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. So that's a warning. You know, I have to take this this illness very seriously. It's not a light thing. I mean, when I was compulsively overeating, I wanted to die. You know, and I thought about suicide, and I was on the top of a building, you know, with food in hand, going, maybe I should just jump. You know, and I was at the side of the road after having refused to give money to some beggar because I knew I needed it for my binge food. And I was sitting there with my binge food, and I was thinking, why don't you just walk across the street? Just don't look. You know, that's where this stuff took me. You know, so it's deadly. We must, or it kills us. That's a warning. God makes that possible. That's a promise. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness but much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. I can't do this by myself. I tried. I really tried. This is the how and why of it. First of all, number one, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Two, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. So God has control. God is the principal. We are God's agent. God is the father. We are God's children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was a keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. So I don't know anything about architecture, but in this book there are lots of references to architecture. So I've learned through the big book a little about architecture. So apparently the keystone is the supporting stone of any structure. So basically, if I'm going to have any kind of continuous abstinence and recovery, I have to get this step. And thankfully, in another part of the book, it says, thankfully, God doesn't make too difficult terms with those who seek God, which is a wonderful thing, because if I were talking about step two, that would be a whole other issue. But I've really struggled with that throughout my recovery, and I've found, I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but I've found that it's been okay. In the beginning, I used the group as my higher power, because I needed to do that, and I could turn, it was much easier to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of the group of Overeaters Anonymous, which certainly had a solution that I didn't. But I'll get there later. Let me continue reading. So when we sincerely, we said, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone to the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. So now, I'm sorry, now we're at the step three promises, by the way. These remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, God provided what we needed if we kept close to God and performed God's work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of God's presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. It says we began to lose our fear. It doesn't mean we completely lost it, which is, it's true for me, but I'm glad, but I have begun to. We were reborn. We were now at step three. Many of us said to our makers, we understood God. God, I offer myself to you, to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to God. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. There's a whole lot in this chapter, and this step, I'm grateful that the steps are in order, and I'm grateful that there's an opportunity to do them over and over and over again, because I've been through all 12 steps multiple times, and every time I do it, I come up with something new. Since I have a little time, I'm going to tell you about my most dramatic experience of step three. And it's how I got abstinent. And forgive me if you've heard this before, but it changed my life. I came into this program over 20 years ago, and I got abstinent in the beginning, and then I started struggling, and I went to Israel for a year. And I went to Israel. My name was not Miriam. It was something different back then. I'll call it Priscilla. It was an unusual name. And so I went to Israel because I wanted to find God. I hadn't figured out God. I wanted to find out if I should become a cantor or if I should become an Orthodox Jew. And anyone who's familiar with Judaism knows that you can't both be a female cantor and an Orthodox Jew. But I thought maybe I should be a cantor because that was sort of where I was going professionally, but I wanted to be an Orthodox Jew because there was this guy. Right, that's all I have to say. So anyway, I thought, if I became Orthodox, maybe he would want me. So, I mean, he wanted me, but I wasn't good enough or whatever. So anyway, so I went to Israel, and it's a long story, but anyway, I started out, I was placed on the kibbutz that owned and operated the largest bread factory in the Middle East. And I was doing the midnight shift. So you can just imagine, okay? So I found myself, as this stuff was going through, just saying the serenity prayer all night. You know, God, please grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And it was insane. And I won't tell you all about my experience there, but I can tell you people there were amazing in terms of the service they gave, the OA service. They took me across country. They translated marathons, three-hour marathons for me from Hebrew to English. I mean, they were took me into their homes, lent me stoves and food, and I mean, just, they were wonderful, but I had not worked the steps yet, and I was crazy, and I left there I was binging my brains out. And so, finally, I got a call from the guy saying, guess what, I've got the greatest news. I just met the most wonderful girl, and we're engaged. So, okay, so then I had permission to leave the country, and I came back, and I was just insane. And I was doing all the things that they tell us to do. I was reading the big book. I was trying to go to meetings. I was writing. I was making phone calls, and I wanted to binge my brains out. And I tried. Somebody said there's a meeting somewhere on a Thursday night, and I tried to go to this meeting. Meeting was closed. Whatever. There's nobody there. And so I stood outside the church, and I read this section of the big book. And I read the third step prayer, which I'm going to share again because I love this, which I now have memorized because I read it every day for a bunch of weeks. So, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And so, so I said this prayer outside this church, and I was crazy, and something in my head just clicked off, and I heard myself say, compulsive overeating disease, you're too powerful for me, you win, I give up. And I went across, and I totally surrendered. I surrendered to the disease, which seems kind of odd, but that's what I did. And I went across the street to the Acme supermarket, you know, intent on binging. I knew exactly what I was going to get. And I walk in the doors, and walking in the opposite doors at the exact same time is this other woman from OA who I barely knew, whose name was Priscilla, you know, whatever my name was, but exactly my name. And she goes like this. And I go, hi, I came to binge. And she couldn't talk, there's something wrong. So she's writing on this pad, and something wrong with her throat. So she's writing, and she's like, let's talk. So I follow her up and down the aisles, and I start blabbing about, you know, I'm just so overwhelmed, and I just came back from Israel, and I don't know what I want to do with my life, and I thought I wanted to be a cantor, and now I don't know. And she writes on this pad, I'm a cantor. I'm like, you're a cantor, your name is Priscilla, and okay, but you don't understand. You see, I'm really crazy, and I really want to eat, and I was trying to go to a meeting, and there's no meeting. And she's like, I'm on my way to a meeting in Pennsylvania. Would you like to come? So I followed her to Pennsylvania to this meeting, and I committed my food to her afterwards, and you know, and I was abstinent within 3 weeks, you know, and I look at that as my miracle, you know, in that I don't know how I turn, you know, I didn't do it. I mean, I just kind of said, I surrender. I turned my will and my life over. Unfortunately, it was to the care of the disease, but somehow it enabled it for God to come in and give me my miracle. And it says also in the AA 12 and 12 that our recovery is a free gift, but in almost every case, we've made ourselves ready to receive that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, that's where my footwork is. My job is to do everything that I possibly can, is to, you know, it says somewhere in some proverb or whatever, you know, pray as if everything depended on God, act as if everything depended on you, something like that. So I have to read the book, I have to show up to meetings, I have to have a sponsor and be a sponsor, I have to work the steps, I have to do my writing, you know, I have to pray and meditate and show up. And then, and I have to ask for help. And then God, that opens a channel for God to come in and do the rest. And on a regular basis, the way that I work step three, so on the big picture, you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood God, is making a decision to work all the steps in my life. And I work my steps. Most of the time I'm living in 10, 11, and 12. In doing that, I've found through numerous four steps, I've come up with yet new character defects, found that for certain things I needed to find another program to work on specific issues, and so I'm now doing the steps in another fellowship right now. Yahoo! But I'm grateful, you know, I'm so grateful that they're here for me, that I know there's a way out. There's a way out to any problem that I have. So that's on the big picture, the way I do it. On the small picture, the way I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand God, on a regular basis, as I said before, it's easier to conceptualize a power greater than myself as the group of OA. So, you know, I turn over my food on a regular basis. I write down my food almost every day. I call it in most days, not every day. But I have a sponsor. I don't make food choices alone. I don't trust myself with food. I mean, I've been, and I guess I should say that that experience that I had on the Acme, that was May 1st. It was just before, I got abstinent on May 1st of 1990. So it's been over 20 years. One day at a time of not compulsively overeating. That's not my doing. You know, I couldn't go past certain places without going in. I just couldn't, you know. So I share my food issues with my sponsor. I don't do it by myself, even after all of this time, because I'm a compulsive overeater. When I wake up in the morning, I ask God for direction and care. So that I do my best to turn my will and my life over. Do I do that with everything? Not necessarily, but I do my best. And throughout the day, I pray, and I say this third step prayer frequently. I used to pray it while I swam laps back and forth and back and forth, and I still do that a lot. So anyway, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here and to do service. Thanks for listening.
Okay. I wanted to kind of wrap things up. I'm Kevin. I'm a bulimic, and kind of just wanted to wrap things up here as far as share some of my own experience with this. I came in through AA, and then my bulimia didn't really surface until I was in my third year of sobriety. And I became active there, and there was this thing going on with me from the very beginning of my life that I was at odds with the world and creation, and I dismissed all authority in my life, and then shortly afterwards, that's when I started using substances to escape my own reality, I got clean, I got sober, and going to 12-step meetings certainly helped, and helped all the real catastrophic things that were occurring as a result of my addictions, but I really never changed, and I was just in turmoil and living in fear about it was awful being sober, clean, and abstinent, and not having any solution to that. I lived in my own prison of having this fear, this horrible, horrible fear of what am I going to do about the next time I have the obsession? What am I going to do? And this tormented me for years. I was abstinent, I was clean, I was sober, and I was going to all these 12-step fellowships, and like some of the other, like Miriam had talked about, I was doing all the right things, And my typical pattern was, I'd have the obsession, I'd run to an old-timer, and they'd give me some activity to do, whether it was inside the program or outside, and that would bring some relief, but then the obsession would come back worse than ever. And this went on for 13 years, this went on for. And I'm clean, I'm sober, I'm absent, and I'm out of my mind. And I looked around me, and no one wanted to be around me because I was absolutely insane. You know, I was a little beefier back then, and I actually was quite intimidating. And I didn't think there was anything wrong. You know, life was beginning to take hold of me, and you know, these operative states of occurrences were happening. You know, and I got to this place where it was just like I woke up one day and it was like, you have to go back to your addiction. This is not a discussion. This is not, you have nothing to do with this. You must go back to your addiction. Fortunate for me, I was living up in Massachusetts, and I found a group of men who were actually working the steps out of the Big Book, and they were actually quite militant about it. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was like going to 12-step meetings for the first time in my life. And I was very fortunate there were a lot of these meetings around, and I just sat there and listened, and I actually did, got myself a sponsor, and I actually went through this process. You know, and I remember him sitting down here and going through this part, these first, four chapters, and quickly taking me through to move me on through this process of change. And I was desperate, I was in great need, and I most certainly needed to have this experience. You know, the book talks about having this psychic change. It also relates to it as being a moral psychology or a spiritual experience. You know, and this is the thing that I lacked. You know, when you asked me, or when my sponsor was asking me at that time, he was saying, "Do you really want to stay? You know, do you really want to?" get over this. Do you really want to, and I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. Because that was the reality. Those 13 years, I was just desperately trying to figure out some way to go back to my addictions. Desperately. And he was like, and you blew it, and you could have been out there having a blast. it's a miserable state to be the hopeless, the hopeless addict, and not have a solution. That is a wretched state. We sit. And I've seen many, many people go through this. And I'm not saying this is for everybody, because it isn't. Some people can get away with just coming to meetings and abstaining. And they can live their lives very successfully. They can, have very fulfilling, full lives. But it talks about it in the book. It's like, what about the real alcoholic? This is the one that's the guy that's been puzzling you. And that's what I had to find out. To really look at this process and to really buy into it, buy into the brainwashing, because it is brainwashing, is to say, do I really have this thing? Am I of the, of the hopeless variety, and there's a series of arguments and considerations as they were put to me, and that's what the one handout is largely about, is these were the considerations, the questions that I had to really buy into, and it led in this succession up, to the point of where I was absolutely convinced that I had this thing, and I desperately needed to have a solution. Bill Wilson's story, if you read his story in the book, his first step experience was when he was drinking, up until the point where he got sober, and then that's when he began to have the rest of his step experience there, and that was certain. I really identify with that. again, this speaker series is to really have you consider doing this work and having this experience. It has been my experience that I needed to have somebody in my life who knew exactly what they were doing. And I'm very grateful for that, to have, many people around me who I ask them to take me through this process. I understand that as being a real sponsorship. You know, somebody that actually, what it actually is you take somebody through the work out of this book. That's sponsorship. You know, I've been blessed to have that experience. And I don't take it lightly. And the warning here is that I've done numerous workshops and have taken a lot of people through the work. This is going to challenge you. It's going to mess you up. It will mess you up. And it is a big challenge. And if you're not ready to do that, you know, it could have very bad results. If you are at a point where it's like, I'll do whatever, you know, I don't care if, you know, I'm up in the plane and I got the parachute on and it's, you know, and I worked at the factory where the parachutes were made and I know they weren't made too well, but I'm going to pull the ripcord anyway because, you know, I'm going to give it a shot, you know. So give it a shot, check it out. You know, this is a take or leave it deal, you know, and it's open to all. And if if this isn't for you, fine. You know, you're welcome to hang out here with us. You're welcome to do what works for you. You know, but I found this to be, you know, a really amazing process. It changed my life. It's brought me to a place where I'm, never thought I'd have the things I have today. So, I just want to put out those words of encouragement. And I guess with some of the time that we have left, we wanted to kind of open up the floor for questions if people wanted to ask any of us anything about the process or our experience, you know, specifically, I guess, about the first three steps. And so, anybody have a question? Anybody here have a question? Yeah,
can someone elaborate on the distinction among rebirth, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, rebirth, or recreation, and the necessary vital spiritual experience?
That's a good question. Anybody want to grab it?
I'll take it.
Good.
A compulsive overeater. I think it all talks about the same thing. In my experience, it has to do with just being willing to turn over our decision-making process to any power greater than ourselves. You know, let that power make our decisions for us rather than self-will. That's my experience, that they all refer to that concept.
So they're all synonymous.
In my experience, yes.
Thank you.
Actually, I think I have a slightly different take on that. There is an appendix at the back, which I'm not going to find it right now, which addresses that, the spiritual experience. I think I will read it. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in different forms. It is confusing because here they're talking about spiritual experience and spiritual awakening almost synonymous and as whatever it is that is necessary to bring about that the psychic change. Having said that, I've also heard them used, heard a distinction with the spiritual experience being, you know, this profound, an experience of something happening to me, which could feel like it's, you know, otherworldly, as opposed to a spiritual awakening doesn't need to be that. There are lots of different ways of they talk in this section on page 567. They talk about it as there is the educational variety. So, and the spiritual awakening is anything that is going to bring on a psychic change, and for many of us, that is a gradual kind of changing that may or may not incorporate a spiritual, you know, woo-woo experience into it. So that's the way I look at it. Sorry, anybody else?
Spiritual experience, in my own experience, has been gradual, and recognizing the daily miracles of the day for me, because when I am into the food or my addiction, I don't see anything, any of the miracles that happen. And miracle, I'm meaning things just working out the way they're supposed to, and accepting that, and having a deep acceptance in my heart that things are working out. And to me, that's how the spiritual experience has been. Very gradual. Some of the stuff are kind of like little aha moments, but for me, it was just getting in that place where I recognize all of the things that my higher power is doing for me.
Actually, one other thing I do want, I can make a distinction from my story. The story where I shared, where I ran into that woman who was a cantor, that was a spiritual experience. But then it was after I turned over my food to her that day, and then later met some people who had worked the steps out of the big book and started working the steps, you know, going on and working for through 11, that, you know, step 12 says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. In fact, that's the experience happened with my woo-woo meeting the cantor. But the awakening happened after I followed that by doing the work, doing the steps, and then I found my thinking became rearranged. After step 9, the obsession with food was removed, the craving was removed, and my whole, and I was, you know, as it says in here, I was put on a new footing, and then my way of dealing in the world changed. That's the awakening for me.
Mm-hmm. Is there a hand over here?
Could one or more of you talk a little bit about how you might use steps 1, 2, or 3 on a daily basis? Thinking especially in terms of our primary purpose and the newcomer or those who still suffer, you know, what do these steps look like just for today, just in one day, if you could describe that?
I'll start. the way it looks for me today is, God, give me the willingness to go to a meeting today. Mm-hmm. God, give me the willingness to make calls today. God, give me the willingness to keep to what food I planned today. God, give me the willingness to read my literature today. God, give me the willingness to lift up my pen today. It's all simple decisions like that.
Also, in terms of on a very simple food basis, sometimes when I first started out, it was step 1. If I was in the grocery store, I'd walk down certain aisles, and I would just somebody said to me to just reiterate step 1 and turn it into a prayer and say, God, I'm powerless over food. Every time I, you know, there are certain aisles I shouldn't be in the first place, but to keep myself from doing that, or as, you know, I was passing by, God, I am powerless over food. And even now, I work somewhere where they bake on a regular basis, and you know, and periodically I will, you know, I'll smell it and I'll just say, God, I'm powerless over food, you know. Or I find in my food plan all of a sudden the manufacturer changes the brand, and I eat it, and I say to my sponsor afterwards, you know, man, that was really good, like that was a little too good, I think, you know. And I'll say to her, my addict really wants to have this again tomorrow, I think. You know, so step 1 is saying, I get it that I'm powerless over this. Step 2, there's a power greater than myself. And this, and at this moment, it's my sponsor. You know, and so I'm sharing with my sponsor and then turning my will and my life over. And I'll say, you know, what do you think? You think I should, like, maybe just for tomorrow not have it? And she'll be, yeah, you know, that sounds like a great idea. So that's sort of on a daily basis.
And I'll also add to that on practicing the principles in all my affairs. There's a situation in my family. God, I'm powerless over this. That's step 1, powerless over this. Step 2, could you restore me to sanity so I don't call every single person in my family and friends and tell everyone what's going on about it and gossip and obsess over it? And then step 3 is, you know what, God, this is yours. I'm not God. You take care of this. And pray, and God, give me the peace to another day, you know, go through this situation with my family.
This woman back here in the back.
How did you deal with the obsessions of the mind in the early stages? The food obsessions. You said it doesn't relieve it from the life step. Well, how did you deal with that in the early stages?
That's a great question. In the early stages, I used that prayer that I said a lot, over and over. Every time I had a thought about food, I would say, God, I am powerless over food, and my life has become unmanageable. And then I would take step two and turn it into a prayer, God, please restore me to sanity. You know, every time I'd have a thought, I'd say that. Secondly, I went to lots of meetings. This is where the tools come in big time. I went to meetings almost every day for the first 3 years I was in the program. I got a sponsor. I mean, just used all the tools, reading, writing, making loads of phone calls. Every time I had a thought before I went grocery shopping, I would call people. And now with cell phones, we didn't have cell phones then. You know, you can call them while you're grocery shopping. I mean, really using the tools while working the steps. That's for me.
I've had experiences where food has called to me, food that I did not commit. And I've prayed at the moment, God, please give me the willingness not to eat this item. And that works. For me, I've never had it happen where that did not work. Now, sometimes I'm kind of willful and I don't want to pray that, and in cases, you know, it doesn't work. But, you know, when I pray for the willingness to be willing, it works for me.
Yes. Let's say I'm having a problem in life. You know, you're not getting along with your boss, or you get a project at work you don't want to deal with. And I've had it been said to me many times, well, take it through the steps. Okay? So that's one concept of program. All right? And I just have difficulty taking another concept through the steps. I have never really been too successful at that. Now, conversely, it'll say, do the footwork and leave the results up to God. And when I listen to these two things, they're diverse. So do they come together? Like, how do you guys see that?
I don't want to be hogging the time, but I had a bad review from a supervisor once, and it was coming up to that time of year again where I was going to be reviewed by him again. And I was talking to a program person, I think it was my sponsor, and there was 12 days before I was to be reviewed by this man. And I thought, you know, well, gee, maybe I should do one step a day about him, my relationship with him, and then 12th day. And so I would, you know, first say, God, I'm powerless over my supervisor and his perspective of me. My life is unmanageable because I'm fear-driven. God, help me. You know, I just like put his name in the place where there was alcohol or food. And by the time the 12th step came, I was willing to accept whatever it was that he would say of me. I was leaving that outcome of the review up to him. And I also had noticed in step four and whatever, you know, areas in which I was deficient in my job and, you know, I was taking action to remedy those. But the outcome of the review was up to him. So that's how I rectified it in that example. I don't know if that would help you, but that's how I did it.
Yeah, but now what about the other day? So in a sense, you were doing the footwork and leaving results up to God. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that they can be both the same.
Yeah, for me, the footwork was doing the 12 steps. And then leaving the outcome up to God was, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you know, tried to carry this message to others. I was improving my behavior at work, and I was making amends by improving my behavior, and I was leaving whatever his opinion was up to him. So that was leaving the outcome up to him. So the footwork was the steps part.
I know for myself, with things like that, I don't know how to deal with things like that. So I have to work with my sponsor, talk it through, talk with other OA people that I know who have gone through the steps, because I don't know how to do that by myself. So to work a situation like that, I do have to go through the steps with it, but I absolutely have to stay. I need that contact, that OA contact.
Yes, you have a question, Ms. Lady?
When you're really frustrated and embarrassed, well, for me, sometimes it's extremely difficult for me to feel spiritual at all. Just angry. How do you, everything that you've all talked about has been, you know, about spirituality. How do you get to that point when you're just so frustrated and angry and you just don't see it? I mean, did you all start out kind of like spiritual type of people?
No. You know what has helped me, and this was from a sponsor years ago, and I read it in one of the texts of we, it said something about we addicts or we alcoholics are of a restless nature. Mm-hmm. And when it's of such, if I'm consumed by anger, and I know there's nothing else that I can do, I just have to sit in silence. Those years ago, when this person had recommended that to me, because of my restless nature, I never did that. And I could always find a way, something to do to avoid the silence. You know, my house was very clean at the time because I would just be avoiding the silence. Oh, I got to wipe down this counter. I got to do this. I got to do that. Sitting in quiet. And this sponsor had said to me, you sit in silence and your higher power will talk to you. And I always remember her saying that. And I had one friend who he used to set a timer because he just couldn't do it. He would set a timer. Even if you don't pray, even if you don't connect at the moment, it's that settling. And as an addicted person, I need that. That's hard to do. But that has helped me in these times where I've been so consumed with anger and I couldn't pray and I couldn't do this and that. Silence.
Actually, that is really fascinating because my experience is really different. When I'm really angry, I have to address that first. I have to address what's most up. So for me, I do a lot of talking on the phone about my feelings. If I have, writing, I can write angry letters, ripping things up. I've hit pillows. I do something physical, swimming, walking, dancing. I mean, anything to release some of that energy because, for me, my experience is that it's very hard for me to get quiet until I've actually addressed some of that negative energy. And I don't have a great answer as to how to get rid of it. I'm still in process on that. And also, one of the other things that it says in the literature is that, in addition to these 12 steps, we can make use of professionals who are there. And I certainly, throughout all this time, have always had a therapist because there are reasons that I overate, and much of it is addressed by the 12 steps, but some of it requires extra help. So,
My experience is that I don't have to feel spiritual. In fact, I most of the time don't. But when I do something that's a spiritual action, even when I don't feel that way, it still helps my recovery. So, in fact, those help my recovery when I do things when I don't want to do them. That helps my recovery more than if I'm doing it because I want to do it. Because I don't want to stay abstinent every day, but I do it. And also, it says in the big book, and I found this works for me, it sounds ridiculous, pray every day for the person you're resentful at or the situation. And, I think of like Ralph Cramden, pins and needles, needles and pins, he would do it like against his will. And I start out praying against my will. God, let wonderful showers of blessings fall on that person. But by the end of 12, 14, 30 days, I feel differently about the situation. Now, the person may or may not have changed. In all likelihood, they haven't. But I've changed, and my perspective is lighter. But again, I don't feel spiritual.
I've also been given permission by a sponsor once that I could include some choice four-letter words in my prayers, and it's still <worked. laughs> so.
May I have?
And it
something?
Has worked.
May I?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I've had that experience, and I still have the experience. And what has helped me, and it wasn't a decision; it was just something I did. I would fall on my knees at my bed, and I would let it rip.
the truth and just let everything come out where I was at. And by the time I emptied myself, I had nothing left to say. I could just get up then and unload the dishwasher, as they say. But because I knew that God heard me, and he knew even before I prayed where I was at, but I knew that there was nothing more I could do at that moment for what I was feeling except to turn those feelings over specifically to them.
We're out of time. However, the guy in the back has had his hand up from the very beginning.
One last question. Do you have that hand back there?
Hi, I'm new to the program and I'm working with Second Step. And I would like to know how to work through a paradox. I think many of us are brought up to be self-reliant, both in education or through parents and mentors. But I found that the self-reliance has become a tyranny, and it's self-destructive, and it perpetuates the insanity and threatens abstinence. How have you worked through this paradox of how you're raised or you become self-reliant, in your case, denying authority? How do you get from that paradox of who you are to sanity?
This process has allowed me to, go through that. I mean, we call it a process because it is. Change usually comes slowly, and I'm kind of grateful for that because I don't think I would like to have a lightning bolt experience like old Bill Wilson did. Although I've had some experiences in my life that have been like that. But I had to go through this, go through the pain, go through that point of being like 13 years, abstinent, sober, and clean, and just be out of my mind till I had enough pain, till I had, exhausted everything, There isn't a simple answer to that. All I could say is have the experience, have a spirit, go through the steps and have a spiritual experience. One of the first people that ever helped me in the program, he said, he really keyed in on something on me, and he said, "You are not a second-class citizen just because you have this addiction. Because you deserve the best, and you should go for the best." And this program really is about that. It accentuates that. We are to really shoot for the best and to be the best. So I'm going to kind of end on something really controversial here. But how it works says that we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. But this most certainly is about spiritual perfection. However, that is not our spiritual perfection. It's the spiritual perfection that we gain from our higher power. I've been sober a long time and blah, 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 but the reality of that is I had very little to do with that. I kind of just showed up, It's, going through we take our turn in the barrel and we go through it, The point is to be persistent. Inconsistent with this process, and if you do that, if you pray for a year, the third step for a year, or you pray for that person you're angry at for several weeks, you'd be surprised at the results. So, all right, we're gonna wrap it up here and.